Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Wally Lamb, whose latest novel is The Hour I First Believed. Earlier novels include She's Come Undone and also I Know This Much Is True. Two nonfiction books are actually collections of material written by prisoners in a women's prison in Connecticut. Couldn't Keep It to Myself and I'll Fly Away. This is the first novel in 9 years. It took a long time to write. And looking over what you've told people in the past, it seems that before it actually began, you were really floundering around. You'd had this huge bestseller. It had been an Oprah book club, and you'd suddenly turned into Harper Lee.
If I remember correctly, it was about a year. See, I had had two Oprah hits, one right after the other, 1997 and 1998. And so that was a pretty wild and exciting roller coaster ride. But then eventually the roller coaster stopped and, I stumbled off and there was the blank page again. You know, for a while, Richard, I really struggled with everybody else's expectations. It took a while. I spun my wheels, and I would have a promising beginning, and then it would fizzle out 2-3 weeks later.
When you say you have a promising beginning, did it have anything to do with what eventually wound up inside this particular book?
No, not that I recall. But when I was finally able to get lost in the story, and for me, the signal is that I start worrying about the character. The character will, I don't only get curious about this person I am pretending to be, but also worried about it, almost in a parental way. And that's when I know I'm off and running. But it took a while.
From what you said in the afterword, it happened you were in New Orleans at St. Louis Cathedral when you suddenly heard as if from on high, my mother was a convicted felon, a manic depressive, and Miss Rheingold of 1950.
Right. Yeah. I didn't hear it in the church, but I heard it about a week and a half after I flew back from New Orleans. But I did go to that church in a pretty forlorn state because I was starting to get panicky. In fact, I even went in to New York, and I was talking to my agent and her associate. I said, maybe I ought to just give this advance money back if I can't come up with anything. And they looked at me like I was, I had just flown in from Mars or something.
Well, when you got those words, how did you deal with that? What was your next step, even knowing that where the heck did Miss Rheingold come from?
do you remember?
Oh,
Miss
sure.
Rheingold
I remember on the subway. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. She came from eBay, actually. One day I was trolling around and looking at stuff on eBay, and there was all this old Miss Rheingold memorabilia. And oh yeah, gee, I forgot about that thing. And it was a pretty big phenomenon back in the 50s and 60s, and I guess the 40s too. That was sort of the fun part, manic depressive, not fun, convicted felon, not so much fun, but Miss Rheingold, 1950, I thought I could do something with that.
Well, when you had that, at that point, did you come up with the character of Calum Quirk?
Yeah, I think so. As I recall, sort of like trying to remember a dream that you had, a year and a half ago, but he was Milo Quirk at the beginning, and his name changed. What I had was his sort of cynicism first. I had that he was sort of disconnected and, he's blown through a couple of marriages and his third marriage is beginning to fail. From that disconnectedness, I sort of branched out and began to write a childhood for him and a backstory and that kind of thing and try to figure out who this guy was and as I'm writing, as if I were he.
Well, there's a small segment in there from his childhood. Was this among the early writings that you did then?
Yeah, yeah. And, he's not a particularly likable guy. I didn't necessarily approve of him. He's got, he's a troubled buckaroo. But I did get to like him through that childhood chapter. A lot of times I'll read that chapter or a sort of a compressed version of it in readings. And, that's fun to read.
You said a second ago that the name Calum Quirk. Well, Quirk, we can talk about Quirky.
Quirk is actually a fairly common surname in my neck of the woods, which is eastern Connecticut. But the name Calum I had never heard before. And as I said, he started out as a guy named Milo. And I work in writer's groups, and I was sitting there with my group one day at a little sandwich shop where we were meeting right across from the University of Connecticut, and an undergraduate guy comes up and he says, "Are you Wally Lamb?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "You named a character after my sister in one of your books." And her name was Zahra, Z-A-H-R-A, and I indeed had named a Cocker Spaniel Zahra. So I said, "Oh, yeah." And he said, do you think you could name a character after me? And I said, well, what's your name? He said, Calum. I said, spell it. So then I went home, and it's like Calum Quirk, Milo Quirk. And so, you know, not only did he become a character, but he became the protagonist.
You know, my first take on Calum, and it's pretty early on, is that he's a man with a great deal of rage.
Yes.
And the first couple hundred pages, few hundred pages, in fact, actually almost to the end of the book, he becomes more likable. He's very difficult to deal with, and I've talked to biographers who frequently say that unless they're subject to someone who they expected to like or knew, they wind up disliking the person because they see the flaws. For years, how do you stay with a character like this who you may not like?
Because I was curious about the source of that rage. You know, nobody's born rageful. And then because I was also dealing with the subject of the Columbine massacre, I was examining that, you know, the rage of those two young murderers. And so it all sort of began to fit together. Now, at the same time, the exact same month that I started the novel, I began almost accidentally of my stint of volunteer teaching at the women's prison. And I saw that a lot of the women that I was working with as they began to tell their stories were incarcerated for having snapped after lots and lots of, you know, bad stuff happening to them, and then they have a rageful moment and next thing you know somebody's dead and they're in prison. So it all began to sort of connect for me. I got really curious about how it all connected.
There's a point now, you say you were writing about his backstory. At that point, had you any idea that Columbine would play a role?
As I recall, it happened pretty early on. And the way it happened, my entree into it, I had maybe 3 degrees of separation from another school shooting, an earlier shooting in Paducah, Kentucky. And what I mean by that is I have a cousin who lived in Paducah, and her daughters went to the high school where that incident took place. And they were very friendly with the older sister of the shooter. I believe he was about 14 years old, a real, you know, troubled kid. But his older sister, I think, was a senior in high school. And I remember my cousin telling me that on the day that chaos happened at that school at the hand of her little brother, that she was just sort of walking up and down the corridor sobbing and sort of, you know, crying to herself and saying, I've never even been in trouble one day at this school. And, you know, without any intention that I was going to write about it, I would think about this poor kid every once in a while and tear up a little bit. And then one day I just Googled, you know, school shootings. And at that point, Columbine had happened, and this sort of tidal wave of stuff comes back at you. The most disturbing of which is the videos that Klebold and Harris left behind, where they're sort of laughing at all of us because, you know, ha, 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 look, they were hiding in plain sight, and, you know, look what nobody saw.
It's difficult for me to read. It's difficult for anybody to read those pages about Columbine. I'm wondering, you immersed yourself into the lives of Harris and Klebold, mm-hmm. and I suspect all of the material in the book about them is true.
Yes, yeah, it's historically accurate. And it was important to me right from the start, Richard, to interface the actual with my fictional characters, because what happened was that those kids really kind of got in my head and were doing a number on me, you know, nothing like the magnitude of the number that they did on the, you know, the families of the people involved, certainly. But both as a father and a high school teacher, which I had been for about 25 years, I felt the need almost to not really do battle with them, but try to, you know, confront them and see if I could figure out who they were. And I was asking myself, you know, were they just sort of depraved? Were they evil? You know, so that it turned into larger questions. And from there, I went into questions about spirituality and the like.
There's an early scene in which Calum goes to the place where they work. Is that fictional, or did someone actually walk in and have those conversations?
The conversations are fictional, but Klebold and Harris both worked at a pizza place called Blackjack Pizza, which is where the scene is, and they were working the Friday night shift, and it was their last shift before they did what they did.
The families and people involved in Columbine, since you wrote the book and since we've read the afterword, have any of them contacted you about the book?
Well, this is very fresh in my mind because it happened. I'm in the middle of a book tour, and it happened just about 3 nights ago in Denver. I was reading at the Tattered Cover, and there was a big crowd and several people who had Columbine-related experiences. And, you know, people were saying that they felt, you know, I was a little nervous about people's reactions. And I had tried very hard to write it responsibly, but, you know, you can't really know how people are going to feel about it. But people were saying they were glad that it's not forgotten, that there's still so much to examine and still so much not to forget, and, you know, the victims and the people that went on. But the thing that really unnerved me is that I had been signing for about an hour or so, and, you know, I got to maybe the 50th or 60th person in the signing line, and I realized a little bit indirectly that it was the father of one of the shooters who had come to the reading. And
which one do you remember?
It was Mr. Harris, and I had written about in the afterword, and I think I also talked to journalists about my concern for the siblings of those two kids. They each of them had one sibling, an older brother, a couple of years older, and you know, from what I knew, you know, good kids, and I just wondered, you know, worried about what a terrible burden, you know, those kids have to labor under. So,
and did he say anything to you about it?
Yeah, he said, "Do you think that this is a book that Eric's brother should read?" And that's when it dawned on me who he was. And we had just this moment, you know, there are like maybe another 60, 70 people waiting for their books to be signed. And I just put my hands out, and he grabbed onto them, and we just, you know, we just squeezed each other's hands for a couple of seconds. Well, longer than a couple of seconds it was. And I said, "You know, I have no answers for you." And he said, "I don't have any answers either." And it was just so, you know, I gave them my email address, and I said, "If you ever want to talk about it, you know, I'm happy to listen." And but it was, I thought it was an incredibly brave thing for him to do, to, you know, show his interest in the book, and also to be there at that signing.
Quirk himself comments upon him, because apparently these are the victims who are never remembered, the family, the mother and father and the siblings, and any attempt to bring it up just creates anger among the others.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and I understand that there were a lot of people in the community who were angry at the Klebolds and the Harrises. You know, how could you not have seen this and so forth? But I believe it's possible, because I think these kids were very good manipulators, and they were very good at hiding their intentions.
You said in the afterword that it felt like it was your responsibility to name the victims. Is that because you were just going to be writing about it and you didn't want to create fictional victims?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did it in a way to sort of remember who those kids were and speak their names, and also remember the kids who were injured and did not die and had to struggle through not only physical but, I'm sure, emotional stuff. What this book became for me is an examination of the collaterally damaged in any kind of chaotic, violent, you know, rage-filled situation. You know, with Columbine and with many things that are addressed in the novel, from Hurricane Katrina to the Coconut Grove fires of in the 40s, there's this ripple effect. There's the epicenter of the chaos, and then, you know, it sort of fans out.
A lot of writers get through a book and then they look back, or other people tell them about themes, but it seemed that two themes were conscious. One was the chaos versus order juxtaposition, and the other is the theme of the maze and the minotaur.
Yeah. I started out writing fiction fairly late. I was about 30 years old, and pretty early on, I slammed into the wall of everything. I still didn't know how to write fiction. So I worked with a mentor, a teacher. I was in a program, a Master of Fine Arts program at Vermont College, and I worked with a woman named Gladys Swan, who gave me great advice. She said, "You know, you're never going to tell an original story, because all the stories that people need have been out in the world, you know, since ancient times." And I'm sure I looked at her kind of dumbfoundedly, and she said, "Go back and read the archetypal stories, you know, read the ancient myths. Those are the plots that people need to be retold over and over." And so that's served me well through three novels now. And this most recent one, the spine of it is the story of Theseus going into the maze to kill the monster at the center. And I began to think of Klebold and Harris as a kind of a two-headed monster, and Calum, you know, going in partly to look for his wife, to find his wife and save her because she has survived the massacre. She was sort of near the epicenter, and she hides in a cabinet and survives. But when she comes out of that cabinet, she's damaged, and she and her post-traumatic stress disorder sort of locks in and becomes really serious.
The Orpheus myth is also playing a role here, I guess. Was that conscious at all?
Yeah, that became conscious. That's not what I started out with, but in the second half of the book, based on, you know, chaos theory, you know, that sort of domino effect, and Calum's wife, partly related to the experience that she had at Columbine, takes a victim herself and ends up in prison. And, you know, this is sort of based on partly on my teaching in a women's prison. I began to see that a prison is a sort of hell or a sort of Hades. And so that's the point at which I began to reread and think about the Orpheus and Eurydice myth and how Orpheus goes down into the underworld to rescue his wife. You know, the caveat is that, you know, he must not look back.
Let's move on to Quirk's family DNA, which is the other side of the story. It's not all about Columbine or even about Maureen. There are huge chunks that take place in the past, in fact. And my first question is, okay, you have Columbine, you have Calum, you have the origins of the ideas of chaos versus order, and then you go to work in the women's prison. At that point, did you suddenly reverse engineer and go back and realize that there was a connection?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And again, it's that maze thing. I was really struck with the irony of a maze. You know, when you're in the middle of it, it makes no sense. It confounds you. You know, you go down these dead ends, and then you have to backtrack. But if you rise above a maze and sort of get an aerial view of it, there is logic, there is order to it, and also you can see the exit strategy. Now, the women that I was working with, and I've been working with them now for about 9 years, so I've seen a lot of, you know, major transformations that they've had by writing about their lives. But a lot of the women that I work with, when they first come into the program, you know, they're hangdog and they're sort of, you know, like really bent over with shame and guilt and confusion. And as they start writing about things like their childhood and their first relationships and so forth, and then take that second important step and share their stories with other people. And, you know, prison is not a place where it's a very good idea to trust a whole lot of people, but there's this sort of oasis of trust that gets created in the workshop. Anyway, the more and more writing that they do, the more and more they understand the arc of their own lives. And so that seemed too like being lost in the maze as opposed to being able to rise above it and look at the bigger picture. So, yeah, it was all sort of fitting together for me.
And at what point did you invent Lolly, his incredible aunt, and you gave her a partner, a pre-gay liberation lesbian partner.
Right.
First of all, why did you do that? What's the role that that plays in there? And at what point did you decide, okay, we're going to look at the history of this prison?
Mm-hmm. Well, the lesbian relationship between Lolly and her partner, Henny. Henny had been an inmate at the prison, and Lolly had been a prison guard. As I have worked in the prison, I've seen a lot of lesbian liaisons that develop between the women that I work with. It sort of fit into that theme of disconnectedness that I had been writing about and how the disconnected long for connection. And so I'm thinking, okay, if you were a lesbian in the 1940s and the 1950s, it would be the thing that dare not speak its name, as they used to say. And so I was interested in the fact that they found each other, these two women. And as far as the history of the women's prison, the place where I teach is a very sort of high-tech, very sterile, very punitive place. York Correctional Institute. And so I got curious at one point, what had it been? I mean, it had been around on that property, beautiful property right near the shoreline in Connecticut. And I began to be curious about what the early thing was like. And I found that it was called the Connecticut State Farm for Women. I was struck by the irony that they seemed more progressive than we are now in that the focus was on rehabilitation, not on punishment. And the philosophy was that if you take primarily these women who had fallen prey to the ills of the big cities, and you put them out in fresh air and sunshine, and you give them, you know, farm work to do, and they get to raise vegetables and fruit for the poorhouse and, you know, give back to the community, that they will get better, they will get well. That's where I got sort of curious about the history of the prisons.
Wally Lamb, as you got curious, did you find the person responsible, and was she kind of similar to your fictional Lizzie Popper?
Yes. Lizzie Popper is based on an actual woman named Abigail Hopper Gibbons, and she was a Quaker in Pennsylvania who then lived in New York. She was very involved with the abolition movement, and then she was a Civil War nurse serving in some of the battles. And then later on, after the Civil War, she went looking for other social justice causes, and she focused on the separation of female and male inmates. See, before that, they used to just throw these, as they called them, fallen women. They were disposable, so they would be thrown into the men's prisons. But Abigail Hopper Gibbons, who was the basis for Lizzie Popper, they wanted to make women better and restore them to the virtues of womanhood. And so, I mean, it's a kind of a dated concept, but their intentions were good, and so she wanted to separate and have females running the prisons, which was a pretty revolutionary idea. I went down to that prison thinking I was going to go one time for a 90-minute class, but once you get in there and you see it and you hear it, you can't then unsee and unhear it. So I kind of fell into this sort of activist role. I call myself the accidental activist.
How did you actually get involved in the prison to begin with?
I got a call. I was finishing up a teaching gig at the University of Connecticut. You know, I love to teach, but I was having trouble balancing the teaching with the writing. And, you know, one is always robbing from the other in terms of time, but also one is always feeding the other. So my teaching makes me a better writer. My writing makes me a better teacher. So I was reluctantly leaving my teaching job at UConn, and I had literally packed up my office, and I was about to hand in my key to the office secretary, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was the librarian at the prison, and she said, you know, we're in trouble down here. There have been a couple of suicides. There have been several more attempts, and we're reaching out to the community. We're trying to distract the women from this epidemic of despair around here. So I said I'd go. Like I said, I thought I was going to go one time. And at the end of that first class, there was a kind of a tough-looking woman whose nickname was Manhattan. For the 90 minutes, she sort of sat there with her arms, you know, clenched across her chest, and she was scowling at me. And she was a little intimidating. And then finally at the end, she threw me a curveball, and she said, "Thank you for coming." And I said, "Oh, you're welcome." She said, "You're coming back?" And it sounded more like a threat than a question. You know, being the wimp that I am, I said, "Okay, I'll come back. But, you know, you write something." I said, "You know, you can come in and with 2 pages of anything, and that's your ticket, and we'll have a writing workshop." Well, I found out when we went from about 35 people down to about 12 or 14 that my real draw for that first thing was, that's that dude that was on Oprah. But what remained were the real serious writers, and they got more serious as we went on.
Did eventually any of them read your books?
Because the teaching and the writing was happening concurrently, as I was reacting to their writing and teaching them how to react to one another's writing, I would bring chapters in as I was writing them, and they would give me feedback. And they're great critics, not to mention terrific research sources.
In terms of Maureen's experiences in the prison, mm-hmm. Did any of those experiences change from first to second draft because of them?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And I didn't get to that part of the novel until they had, for maybe 2 or 3 years, been educating me, not only about the sort of complicated equation by which women get to prison or go to prison, but also what happens when they get there. So through their writing, I was learning, too. So there was this really wonderful sort of symbiotic thing that was going on.
Katrina happened in 2005. You'd already been working on the novel for quite some time at that point.
Yes, yeah.
Did you have to do rewriting to suddenly bring in these characters? Did they exist in another form, Moses and Janice?
What happened, Richard, was that I had that opening thing where I'm going to St. Louis Cathedral and praying to find a story. And then, you know, several years go by, and then our oldest son entered the Teach for America program and was posted in New Orleans.
In the Ninth Ward, right?
In the Ninth Ward at a high school where he was teaching biology. And he had finished his 2-year stint in Teach for America and decided to stay. And it was the beginning of his third year there that Katrina came in and wiped out the high school, and some of his students perished. And he went to Houston for a year and taught New Orleans kids there and then returned. And he's there now, as is his younger brother, our son Justin, who's also teaching down there as well. Now I've made many visits to New Orleans, and Katrina was very much on my mind. And when I was able to sort of drive through that Ninth Ward, that was my emotional touchstone in the creation of the mix.
That part wasn't written at that point,
no.
And you just knew that, like, when you're working on this, obviously, I mean, there are various overlays. One other overlay we haven't discussed is the butterfly versus the mantis.
Mm-hmm.
Part one is a butterfly,
mm-hmm.
part two,
mm-hmm.
not quite sure about what that means,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, when you're doing that, I mean, did you have an overall sense? Did you know, for instance, the secrets when you were starting the book, and how did they emerge?
The family secrets?
Oh, yeah.
No, I didn't know them. They emerged, you know, you set a snowball going at the top of a hill, and it picks up velocity, and it picks up density, and that's sort of the way that story got written. You know, I'm always envious of writers who know what the ending is going to be and write toward that ending and outline the chapters and all that kind of stuff. Man, I think I could churn books out faster than I can, but it's just not the way that it works for me.
The butterfly, which I guess is the Columbine section, and the mantis, which mm-hmm. is the prison section.
Mm-hmm.
What are these symbols for you?
Well, butterfly for me represents chaos. You know, there's a sort of a cliche about chaos theory and its sort of chain of events. You know, a butterfly flaps its wings in Africa and it causes a tsunami, you know, on the coast of South America, that kind of thing. And of course, I was dealing with the repercussions of Columbine in that section. And part two, which is called Mantis, sort of harkens back to an early chapter in the book where a praying mantis egg case, which everybody assumes is dormant, sort of explodes and tiny babies exist. And that's actually based on an actual thing. When I started this book, my son Teddy, who is now 18 years old, was 8 years old. And he came home one day, last day of school, with a praying mantis egg case. You know, it was a failed science experiment. It had never hatched. And then about 3 or 4 weeks into summer vacation, he's calling up the stairwell, "Dad, come downstairs quick, I'm a father." And I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, please, God," you know. But anyway, what he meant was that this, you know, this egg case had finally hatched. And to me, that became a sort of a symbol of hope. And, you know, that so much of what was happening in the novel was bleak and scary. And I held on to that image for the entire writing of the story.
How scared were you that you couldn't somehow pull it together?
I was very scared. I was frightened throughout the whole writing. First of all, I was scared that I couldn't tell the story. And then as I'm sort of in the middle of it and the canvas keeps getting wider and I'm back to the 19th century and so forth, then I'm scared that I can't make it all fit together. And then that fear segued to my fear that I couldn't finish it. I wouldn't know how to end it. I kind of worried my way through this entire novel.
Were there large sections that eventually got removed?
No.
Really?
No. You know, smaller things here and there. There were things that I began to intend to do that I dropped along the wayside. 700 pages is, you know, enough to ask of the readers without, you know, without delving into more stuff.
One thing about writing a book over a long period of time, when you're delving into so many different areas, from gay rights to terrorism, environmentalism, safety in nightclubs, when you're doing that, you change too. I mean, time changes, and of course people change too, mm-hmm. but writing must change you too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Because I'm writing as people who I am not, taking on their voices and their stories, I'm writing myself into situations that I don't really know about. When I wrote, "I Know This Much Is True," there's no schizophrenia in my family, and yet I was writing about the brother of somebody who suffers from the disease. With She's Come Undone, my first novel, I was writing from the point of view of a woman, an obese woman. But the payoff for me, I mean, writing is hard for me, and I don't love doing it necessarily, but I fall in love and worry about these people, and I have to keep writing to find out if they're going to be okay or not. And because it takes a while, what happens is that in the shedding of my own skin and putting on the skin of somebody else and living their life during my workday for several years, I come out knowing things. I come out of the process knowing things that go beyond the limitation of my own experience. You know, I broaden my understanding, and I think I broaden my empathy with people who are not necessarily like me.
Well, there's a character named Velvet who threads her way through the whole novel. Was she always there?
Yeah, she appears in the second chapter, and I think that might have been the first chapter that I wrote. sequentially. I mean, sequentially now in the novel, in the finished novel, it's chapter two. But I think I started with Velvet, a troubled kid who marches into Caleb's class one day when he's the high school teacher at Columbine. She's got a blue crew cut and a real, you know, bad attitude, and she's a bruised kid who is a bruiser too.
Alcoholism plays a role in the mm-hmm. book because even though there is an alcoholic in the book, it isn't until the final pages that we become aware, even though I guess it's been there all along, mm-hmm. that Caleb's an alcoholic.
Yeah, that it has creeped up on him, and the pain of having dealt with his wife, and also his father had been the town drunk. And so he has the genetic predisposition, or may be carrying that, but also he's been trying to medicate himself and dull the pain of not only his disconnectedness, but also not being able to help his wife. You know, she's sort of on this island of grief that he can't get to. Now, the touchstone for that is that I mentioned our youngest son, our third son, Teddy. He is our adopted son. He came to live with us when he was four, and his birth parents are drug-addicted, hardcore alcoholics. And so alcoholism has had a huge effect on our lives. You know, Teddy arrived with, some pretty heavy-duty trauma himself. And so that sort of played itself into the novel.
In an interview, you call yourself a practicing Catholic, but a questioning one, because, of course, this is about belief. It's never quite clear what exactly he believes the first hour he believes. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at the Catholic religion, mm-hmm. how are you able to separate what happens from the political end from your own beliefs?
Because for me, having been raised a Catholic, it's part of who I am, whether I approve or disapprove of some of the dogma and some of the political actions of the church that kind of creep me out. It's sort of like saying, oh, I'm not going to be Italian anymore. I'm half Italian. It's like, oh, I'm not Italian anymore. I'm not a Catholic anymore. So there's this sort of interior thing that's going on. Now, I go to church still. I don't necessarily invest in, buy into a lot of what the church is saying, but I do approve of the social justice initiatives, the helping of Haitians or the like. I like that part of it. And when I go to church, there's always usually this one or two little nuggets, whether it's a phrase in a song that's being sung or something that a parishioner says to me as I'm leaving or something. There are these little small gifts that sort of, reinforce my spirituality, which sort of I'm not fully able to define it myself. You know, that gets back to the title of the book, The Hour I First Believed. Unlike my first two books that I couldn't name them until I had the story. This time I had the title before I had the story or the character. And that was sort of the riddle that kept me guessing for 9 years. And finally, it was very close to the ending of the writing of the book when I figured out what Caleb does believe and the hour in which that happened. I also wanted to just mention briefly the cover of the book, which depicts a hand that's gripping a candle that's burning at both ends. And to me, that represents the two parts of the book. The candle burning upside down is nonsensical, and as nonsensical as two of your classmates coming in and, killing a bunch of people in the library. Chaotic, nonsensical. And yet the other side of the candle is burning sensibly and logically and maybe illuminating something. I saw in that image the two sides of the novel, the first of which examines how a random act of chaos can send your life reeling off in a direction that you hadn't intended. And then the upright candle, for me, symbolizes the possibility that of an ordering principle, whether that's a God or whether that's biology and DNA coming out right. So that's, for me, it's a symbol that really works for the two parts.
Did you come up with the idea for that cover then?
No. The editorial director had an idea for the cover. He wanted a blue butterfly on the cover, chaos. I said, well, that's only half of the story. So we went back and forth, and then I found a German surrealist painter named Quint Buchholz, and there were two figures of a man and a woman who looked to me like my characters. So that was going to be the cover, and then some people didn't like that cover. then just when I thought I was going to have to pick one or the other, they threw it back to the art director at HarperCollins, and they said, come up with a bunch of different covers. And he did. He came up with about 10 possibilities. And I saw that candle, like, oh, that's it. That's better than, you know, anything else we came up with.
Did you know the last words of the book would be "The Hour I First Believed," even then at the beginning?
No. I purposely left it somewhat ambiguous as far as what Calum comes believe, because I feel that once I finish a book and send it out there, it's not mine anymore. It's it belongs to people who choose to read it. And so I didn't want to sort of preconceive for my readers. I wanted the story, as they receive it, I wanted it to be filtered through what they believe or challenge what they believe. And so I kind of kept it a little bit open-ended. I know in my head what I think Calum came to believe, but I throw that riddle to the reader and say, okay, what do you think?
Will you tell us?
I'll tell you this much, that I think what he comes to believe in is the interconnectedness between the past and the future. You know, the future, there's a pregnancy at the end of the novel, and there's also the fact that he now has his ancestor's story and his own genealogy sort of straightened out. I think Calum believes in the forward thrust of life in a way that he maybe had never accepted before.
Wally Lamb, you've now got these three books. Have any of them gone to Hollywood?
Yes, the first two have, and there they've sat, you know, in the production companies. She's Come Undone has been with Warner Brothers for 15 years. The project heats up, and then it cools down, and for a while, Reese Witherspoon was going to star as the main character and also produce it, and then she turned in a different direction. There was a director named Lasse Hallström, who was originally attached to a wonderful director, a young actor slash filmmaker named Zach Braff, famous from his TV
Scrubs.
Sitcom, Scrubs. Yeah. And he was thinking about rewriting the script and making it his next project. But, you know, none of those has caught fire. I Know This Much Is True has been bought by 20th Century Fox. Will Smith has expressed interest in playing both of the twins, and now I understand he's no longer interested in it. My experience with Hollywood is that it's sort of like you're back in high school and the coolest and cutest girl keeps hinting around that she may want you to take her to the prom, but, you know, she can never make a decision.
What's opened up now, and I think it's pretty recent, it's certainly since I Know This Much Is True has come out, is the idea of the serious multiple episode miniseries that will be on Showtime or HBO, right. Something like Empire Falls,
right.
Or Angels in America.
And yeah. It's funny that you should mention Angels in America, because when I was losing my nerve often enough with the writing of this book and the way it kept expanding in terms of what it was trying to cover, in the middle of it I went to see Angels in America, you know, part one, and then a couple of days later part two. And Tony Kushner, he was the one that sort of pulled me through. I said, you know, he did this amazing job of, you know, all this disparate things, and he made it work. And so he was, one of these days I'd like to meet him and shake his hand and say thanks.
Wally Lamb, obviously you haven't started work on another one yet, have you?
No. What I have, again, is these lists. I'm going from city to city on this book tour, and I have a notebook with me, and as things come up, I've got these little bits and pieces. One of my favorite uncles, my Uncle Joe, he gave me, before he died, a pencil sketch that he had done of Lou Gehrig when he was watching him take batting practice back way back when, and Lou Gehrig went by my uncle as he was drawing the picture, and he said, hey, that looks just like me. Let me sign it. So I have Lou Gehrig smiling at me in my office, so I suspect that he may be sneaking into a story somehow. But that, you know, I have, like, little leads there.
Well, given the fact that even The Hour I First Believed, A History of the Minstrel Show, there are so many elements.
Right.
Before we go, how did that get in, by the way?
Gosh, I can't even remember. Well, you know, the whole subject of racism, you know, having grown up in the 60s, and, you know, that's one of the things that I am still concerned about. And, you know, sort of as the political stuff began to sort of shift and, you know, talk about, you know, despair versus hope, Bush versus Obama, you know, I began to sort of not only look at that past but also look at that future. A lot of people ask me, you know, how are you and Calum alike? And, okay, you know, we are in some ways, we're teachers and blah, blah, blah. But the way they're, I think the better question is, how are we not alike? And, you know, Calum is cynical, and I'm not. And so I held out hope all through the writing of this book that Calum could be all right, and also that maybe our country could be all right again. And then, you know, lo and behold, I finished the novel, and we have the election in November, which is not to say that there aren't going to be problems ahead. But, you know, I feel better about things than I have in a long time.
It's interesting, after 8 years of everybody being tormented about what's going on, the worst, I remember I interviewed Ursula Hegge. That was during the invasion of Afghanistan, where she was actually afraid that free speech was going to disappear because it appeared that way, particularly on the East Coast. It was a little different the further you got from Washington and New York. You know, that was a low point
right.
in 2001 to 2003 or so.
Right. Well, in the period just before the invasion of Afghanistan and the Iraq war, the writer Dennis Lehane put a call out to writers, and he said, I'm going to take a full-page ad out in the New York Times saying just basically, Mr. Bush, please exhaust all avenues of diplomacy before, you know, you take us to war. And I remember in that – it's easy to forget, but I remember in that sort of mood and temper, you know, he asked people to contribute to the ad and also to sign their names to it. And I paused a little bit. I eventually did. But, you know, it's like, is this going to be safe to do this, to sort of declare your political intentions in an ad in the New York Times when anybody who seemed to be – in opposition to some of the Bush policies was, you know, considered to be unpatriotic. So I think we tend to forget just how squelched we all were and how hesitant and careful we were to speak our minds then.
You've been listening to an interview with Wally Lam, whose latest novel is The Hour I First Believed. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.